Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For the 20-something woman of New York and L.A., are the streets paved with gold? Good morning. David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The wage gap still exists in most places in the country. Women still do not get equal pay for equal work. But recent data shows that in big cities like Dallas, L.A., and New York, the wage gap is actually different. Young women here earn 117% of men's wages. But is that all good news? Joining us now to talk about this are Andrew Beveridge, a demographer at Queens College. He's also the author of a report on the earning power of urban 20-somethings that first appeared in the Gotham Gazette. You can find the link to that on our site at WNYC.org. Just click on the Brian Lehrer Show page. Also here is Jane Selwyn, Dean of Career Development at Barnard College, and Lois Frankel, founder of Corporate Coaching International, and author of a number of books, most recently See Jane Lead, 99 Ways for Women to Take Charge at Work, which comes out or came out in April. Andrew, welcome back. Jane and Lois, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you.
It's David in for Brian, but
yes,
good morning.
Thank you, David.
Let's get you in on the conversation. Are you a young working woman, or are you a mom with a 20-something daughter who can give us a little comparison on how you see the workforce today compared to when you started out? You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also make a comment on our webpage by going to WNYC.org and clicking on the Brian Lehrer Show. So, Andrew, tell us what you found and where you got your data.
Well, the data come from a variety of from census surveys, the large census surveys in the decennial, and then the new American Community Survey. And basically, I took all of the women and men who worked full-time, which was defined as at least 35 hours, at least 40 weeks a year, and then I compared their income, and it's 21 to 30, in terms of median income, other income, and in that regard, women had now finally gotten ahead of men in 2005, but they were not ahead in 2000. And I was actually quite surprised by it, because the original idea of this article was to look at, see how sort of young recent grads or young people were doing now compared to 1970.
So was there a difference in the salaries of, say, white, Latinas, blacks, as compared to men?
Well, there is, particularly for blacks and Latinas, and I think that really goes to the point about what is driving this. One of the major things that's driving this is that women in New York in this age category are much better educated than men in New York in this age category, at least among those who are working. And so since women are so much better educated, even if a woman in a given occupational category or job doesn't make quite as much or makes, 80 or 90% of a male income, there's so many more women in those better paying occupations generally that overall the median income of women is higher than the median income of men.
Did you find any specifics in terms of what types of jobs you were talking about?
Well, we did find, I think, I'm a little nervous about it because, even though it's a very large sample, you're starting to slice and dice because it's effectively a 1% sample in 2005 of the country. But when you start cutting down, I think in New York it's based on a sample of something over 5,000. So then when you say, okay, let's take the given occupation, there really aren't probably enough people in it to be completely confident in the result. But there are some occupations where women actually are ahead of men. I think one is law, but I don't think there are enough lawyers to make that an estimate that you'd want to hang your hat on.
Did you say there's not enough lawyers?
Well, no, there's not enough lawyers in the whole. There's enough lawyers in New York. In that sense, but there's not enough in the sample.
Jane Selwyn, do professional aspirations differ between men and women? What do the women you counsel in career services say they're looking for?
Contribute to whatever type of organization they choose to work in. And our students are very capable, very talented, and they are interested in just about any professional area you can think of. So many of them will go on to graduate and professional degrees after Barnard, perhaps not immediately after, but not too long after. And so they are interested in just about any field you can imagine, and many of them do expect to end up in Manhattan in working very successfully in lots of different areas.
Andrew, how much the data that you looked at was from 2005. Do we know what the numbers might look like today?
Well, we're going to know actually on September 12th, because on September 12th, the 2006 American Community Survey will be released, so we'll know if the trend that we spawned in 2005 is still there in 2006. But I expect it to be there. And you know, coming on from what the last speaker said, there's another article that I wrote for the Gothic Gazette, which is actually the article right before this, which was called Women in New York. And it shows the amazing variety of occupations that women in New York, and particularly women in Manhattan, pursue in comparison to the rest of the country. And I think that article, along with this article on men and women income, really starts giving you a notion of how this is happening. In other words, women are in all sorts, you know, in every career field you could name in Manhattan.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on The Brian Lehrer Show. Joining us, Andrew Beveridge, demographer at Queens College. Also, Jane Selwyn, dean of career development at Barnard College. And Lois Frankel, founder of Corporate Coaching International. Andrew, how much, you were talking a little bit about the number of males enrolling in college being on the decline. I think the number now is 44% of college undergrads. And women, you said, seem to be much better educated, at least in the cities that we're talking about. So does this mean that in terms of earning power, education trumps gender?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in other words, if a person is, you know, say something like a lawyer or a doctor, they're going to earn a lot of money. It turns out if they make 10% less than, you know, a man, they're still earning a lot of money. And, you know, if you to get into those positions, you need to have, you know, high education. And I think the other point that has to be made, and one of the, if you roll it back to 70 and look at the original Gotham Gazette column, you'll find that women were not able to earn that in 1970, and there's a very simple reason for that, I mean, at least one, and that is that until the Civil Rights Act of 1968 was passed, women, you know, including women from Barnard, were not likely to get into, you know, they didn't get into medical school, law school, et cetera, on the same terms as men. And, you know, then there's the famous example of Sandra Day O'Connor and Judge Rehnquist. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor and Judge Rehnquist come out of Stanford Law School at about the same time, and Judge Rehnquist gets offered an associate in a major San Francisco law firm, and Sandra Day O'Connor gets offered a job as a legal secretary, even though I think she was higher in the class than he was.
Lois Frankel, how much do shows like Sex and the City serve as an influence for young women, just in terms of making career focus permissible or even hip?
Oh, I think they make a huge difference. You know, in fact, it's not just television shows, but it's the music that young girls listen to. We know that by the time a girl reaches about age 13, 14, that's the time when she'll tend to dumb down if she wants, because boys become important. Mm. She doesn't want to look, you know, she doesn't want to outshine the boys in her class. So even though our expectations for girls have changed over the past 20, 30 years, in some ways, we still expect them to behave in similar ways.
Yeah, though I think that there is a kind of a counter image now in the culture that might be best depicted by the two recent Judge Apatow movies, Knocked Up and now Superbad, which really paints males as, you know, kind of slackers, whereas women are very, very ambitious and organized. I mean, particularly Knocked Up is like that. I mean, Seth Rogen is a slacker, whereas the very lovely woman from Grey's Anatomy, whose name I can't remember right now, is a working in media, is very ambitious. And so there is kind of almost a flip, I think, in some ways on the image.
Yeah, and that's true. But at the same time, as you said, they're still earning 10% less.
Yeah, I think that is right.
And as they rise up through the corporate ladder, there's less opportunities available to them. Otherwise, we would see more women leading Fortune 500 companies. We'd see more women on boards of directors. So that there does become a point where there is a glass ceiling, or as someone from the Wall Street Journal said, you know, a glass treehouse.
All right, let's get some of you in on this conversation. Working women or moms with 20-something daughters who can give us a little comparison on how you see the workforce today compared to when you started out. Our number here is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. You can also make a comment on our webpage by going to WNYC.org and clicking on the Brian Lehrer Show. Let's get Falana in here. Falana, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just want to make a comment as a 25-year-old working woman in New York. I think there's still a large disparity between women making money in New York and men. All my male counterparts seem to be making $75,000 more than me. And regarding education, women have to rely on our education because we're not going to get union jobs in construction. We're not be able or become plumbers making $50 an hour. We have to excel in academics. And once we do get these great jobs in our 20s. But the second we start thinking about family, we hit a roadblock, and suddenly our careers go south, and we're stuck in the same position we were at age 30 when it comes to retirement age.
Jane Selwyn, comment on that?
Well, I think that there's the caller has made a very good point. I do think that there are certainly areas where women are clearly discriminated against, but I do think that women are getting very creative about how they're shaping their own career lives. We have a lot of women who are starting their own businesses, and they're and I think that this particular generation that's going in the workplace right now is expecting that they will be able to have both successful personal lives and successful professional lives. And at the moment, with all of the demographic news we're hearing about the boomers leaving the workplace, I think that lots of employers are listening to this generation of highly capable young women and men, and they are making accommodations that they never would have considered making in the past. And I see that as very exciting and very good news for the future, perhaps for all women. And I didn't say before, but I did mean to, that I want to thank Andrew for good news. We always like good news about women making more money, so I thank you for that.
Yeah, I want to make a point, actually, about that. And after that article appeared, I've noticed that female reporters are much more interested in these findings than male reporters.
So these women in their 20s, but in a few years, they may want to take a detour to raise a family, as Falon mentioned, or take care of older parents. What's going to happen to their earning power when they get back in the game?
Well, I think if they do take a detour, it obviously is going to detract from their earning power. I would want to mention, though, that if you look at this over time, you know, if you take cohort by cohort, like take the next cohort, the 30 to 40 cohort, it turns out that they are much closer, and in fact, I think in New York they're slightly ahead, but they're much closer than, you know, if you go back and you take this, when they were 20 to 30, they weren't, you know, on par. And, you know, so there's been even a little bit of gap closing there. But I think beyond that, you have a situation where, you know, it is an ongoing trend. See, I see this as a harbinger of a real ongoing trend. And I believe that if, in fact, men do not decide to go to college, that women ultimately will, in effect, in many fields. Now, I mean, Wall Street is notoriously not like this, but in many fields, women will be making more money than men. And I think the other point that has to be made is that as this develops, women will be the ones making the hiring decisions. You know, it's not like that they're going to, you know, they're not going to win. It'll be a slow permeation of the glass ceiling, but this may be a, you know, kind of a watershed shift, because in other words, when women became equal, because if you look back in 68, I mean, women, unlike African Americans or Latinos, women and men didn't. Women did not really suffer a major educational decrement compared to men. The minute that women had the opportunity to move into the professional schools, to move into professional jobs, they started doing so. Now some of the gap is closed, you know, at those levels. More and more women are pouring into these. So if you look at this over time, it may very well turn out that we're seeing, you know, the harbinger of a trend where women actually will generally and consistently out-earn men. I mean, you know, this is a possibility. People always say, well, no, maybe this will go away, but maybe it won't go away. I mean, think about that.
Lois, how do you counsel your clients about planning for children and so on?
You know, that's a big question. A lot of people ask me that. And they say, you know, can you really have it all? And I say, yeah, you can have it all. You can't have it all at the same time. So what I tell women is that you need to be strategic about planning your life and your career. So, for example, if you're about to start a family, move to a neighborhood where there's a lot of support. Move to a neighborhood where you know there's going to be other parents around, maybe moms who are stay-at-home moms, that can help you out somewhat because you need to have that support system. Also, be strategic about the kinds of things you can get involved in. You know, some moms say, you know, I wish I could be the class mom. Well, you know, guess what? If you're a vice president at a bank, you can't be the class mom, but you could take 3 days off and be a chaperone on a field trip. So I'm counseling women to just be strategic about how they make these decisions, about how they're going to combine family and career. And I think it can work for them because I've seen it work for women.
David, can I just jump in here?
Sure, Jane.
I think that one of the great advantages that we have at Barnard, being in New York City, is all the opportunities that our students have to connect with other women who are doing very successfully just what Lois was talking about, and to learn from them about the particular models that have worked for them. We have something called the Barnard Leadership Initiative that includes a Learning from Leaders series with on-campus speakers, students going to off-campus events, a networking event, and skills development series. And all of those help to prepare our young women to be that type of strategic thinker about planning their lives that Lois is really encouraging women to consider.
Well, I also think that, you know, another thing that may be happening and is kind of happening, and, you know, it's another thing that people don't really like to necessarily mention, and I don't know if it's good news or bad news, but the marriage age has gone way up. I think it's, you know, hovering around 28 now. May even be higher for, you know, high-performing professionals. So people may be delaying marriage, and I think, as you were saying, strategically, they may be delaying child-raising. But it also may turn out that, you know, people may, you know, if you delay it long enough, you didn't have the child. And, you know, when we talk about this, like, how are women going to, you know, raise a child, there's sort of an implicit assumption here that that's going to be born privately, that, in other words, someone is going to, in effect, have to step up and give up his or her career so the children could be raised. If you look at it from a different perspective, what that means is that we have now turned child rearing in the United States into kind of a very expensive hobby. You know, in other words, should I have a child? It's going to cost, you know, there's like the nominal cost of several hundred thousand, plus I'm going to completely divert my career. Well, guess what? In the United States, among native-born people and throughout Europe, we are not at the replacement rate for children. In other words, there's fewer children being born than it would take to replace the population. And there's a very good reason for this, because the way in which child rearing is dealt with in the United States, and, you know, it's less so in some of the European countries, but even there the replacement rate is not there. Guess what? In the United States, if you raise a child, it's your own private business.
All right, David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Andrew Beveridge, a demographer at Queens College, Jane Selwyn, Dean of Career Development at Barnard College, and Lois Frankel, founder of Corporate Coaching International. We're talking about gender and wages. Morning, David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking about a reverse wage gap. Our guests are Andrew Beveridge from Queens College, Jane Selwyn from Barnard College, and Lois Frankel, founder of Corporate Coaching International. Joining us on the line is Helen in Brooklyn. Helen, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just had a question about the racial aspects of it. From what I remember, the graph I saw last week in the New York Times, that most of the difference, the greatest difference, was among African Americans, and it was really a slight difference among Caucasians. And I want to know how much of overhyping this. Is this really just a vestige of, you know, the difference we're seeing among African Americans of past discrimination against black men? You know, what percentage of the difference is due to discrimination against minority men, since the city is majority-minority?
All right, Helen, thanks for your call. Andrew?
Well, I think, you know, what you have here is you have a trend that goes across the three racial groups. And the trend, as I try to mention, is that women are much better educated than men. And it's even more so among African-American women and Latina women. In other words, I think with African-American women, it may have gone above 2 to 1. In other words, two times as many female college grads as male college grads, you know, taking college grads. Same thing applies to dropping out, et cetera. But you have to remember, these are people who have a job and are working full time. So, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not contaminated by the prison population or stuff like that. So I do think that that's a point, but I don't know if it's directly the discrimination against African-American or Latino men. I think it's more likely an issue of African-American and Latino men sort of opting out from education. And, I mean, I can't stress it enough. You know, women got ahead in education. I believe it might have even been by 1980. They were certainly on par by 1980. By 1990, they were well ahead. And so women getting more education and to men, it really raises the question, like, what's going on with the men?
James is in Brooklyn. James, welcome to the program.
Yes, I wanted to ask if anybody's already talked about, the gentleman did touch on something earlier about the difference between Europe, for example, and the United States. The United States is the only country, you know, industrialized country in the world that does not provide some kind of daycare, government-supported daycare. This makes an enormous difference in the ability of people, men and women, to be able to, A, raise children, and you pointed out the fact that we're losing a population all the time, and B, to provide what is necessary in the culture for the economy to be supported by the individuals who are in the economy, men and women, workers. What is wrong with putting more pressure, or pressure at all, on the government to provide what everybody else in the world, in other words, another step in joining the rest of the world, so that people in the United States can get what they can in France and Germany in terms of being able to provide daycare for their children so they could, A, work, and B, raise children at the same time.
All right,
yeah,
James.
They have daycare. They also have, like, parental leave that's paid, so they get to help the kid when it's very, very young. In France, they send in actually help. I mean, it's amazing. You know, it's amazing. I mean, this has been privatized, you know, and you know, right now they're not even clear that they're going to reauthorize the child health bill, you know, so the kids would have poorer parents would be able to pay for their kids' health insurance. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you're absolutely right.
Lois, any sense that the workplace is becoming more accommodating to women or moms?
Yeah, in some ways it is, in some fields. For example, you know, in IT, they're actually less accommodating than they were 10 years ago. And one of the reasons was because, you know, 10 years ago there was a real glut, and in order to get anybody who fogged a mirror, you know, they had to make some accommodations. But in other organizations, you know, particularly I'm seeing it a lot in professional services firms and financial services firms, where they're establishing affinity groups for women. And these are designed to help women understand and to learn. How do you work through the culture? How do you get access to the senior decision makers? You know, and I think savvy companies are getting it, that we are waging a war for talent. And if, as Jane pointed out, women are leaving the workforce to start their own businesses, because quite frankly, a lot of times they can make more money. I mean, it's one reason why I started my own business. I left corporate America, and I said, you know what, this isn't going to happen if I stay here. So, yeah, I think savvy companies are saying, yeah, this is what we have to do to attract and retain talent.
Jane, one of the things that's viewed as traditionally having held women back is their negotiating skills or lack thereof. Do you see that as still an issue with young women?
I think that it is an issue. I think it's something that women need to learn, and they can learn. And so that's part of one of the kinds of things that we pay attention to here at Barnard in trying to prepare our students to be successful in the workplace in lots of different ways, including negotiating. And it's I think that Lois has made some very good points in her books about the kind of socialization that girls go through and how that can sometimes be an impediment. And it's certainly something that we pay attention to here. We have a financial fluency program, for example, to help students to plan their personal finances and budgeting and to think about negotiating their salaries along with that program. So it is something that we do pay attention to.
Studies do show, I just want to tag on to what Jane is saying, studies do show that when women and men go in to negotiate for money, women negotiate for less. And, a couple of the reasons are because they feel as if until they've proven themselves, they don't have the right to ask for more money. Men don't go in with that attitude.
Yeah, I think there is something also in the culture. I think men, I've always believed that it had to do with the fact that, men are much more likely to be in competitive sports and gaming, that whole thing. And so they, they're more willing to view something like negotiation as a game. Whereas women take it more seriously in a way, Like they think it's a real thing, whereas a man says, well, it's just a game. Let me ask for too much salary. I think also there's some studies that show that men have a much, there's a male ego. Men have a higher opinion of themselves than women.
Jane, you mentioned a group called Ladies Who Launch, a sort of support group for women who want to be entrepreneurs. You also mentioned to us that women are going into starting their own businesses more, yeah?
Yes, absolutely, and we see that. And I think it's self-employment as well as starting your own business, and so it would be a range from women lawyers who may partner with each other specifically so that they can make the types of personal life accommodations that they're interested in having to someone who may have a great idea for a new service and launches it herself with using a website. We see a variety of different models and much more interest in entrepreneurship in recent years than we ever saw in the past.
All right. Jennifer from Brooklyn is on the line. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hi. How are you doing?
Very good.
Well, recently in May, the Supreme Court made a ruling on a case where a woman who worked at Goodyear Tire Company had worked there for 20 years and suddenly discovered that she was making less than every other man at work, even people that worked underneath her. And she took it to the Supreme Court, and they determined that she waited too long to bring up a case about it. And the Supreme Court made a ruling that unless you have a dispute within 180 days after your pay is set, you cannot hold your employers accountable.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jane.
Jennifer. Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, sorry, Jane.
Thank you. Well, Jane, I like what you were saying about women and negotiation and how they need to be, more aggressive. But at the same time, if you don't know what you're other people are making, how can you even begin to make a judgment of what you should negotiate for?
That's a good point.
And if employers aren't required to tell everyone and have an open, salary policy, then you have no way to negotiate.
Well, I think that's why women's networks are so very important, so that women can share that information with each other. And there are so many of them now that are available to young women to learn exactly what they should expect in certain fields and when they should expect to be moving and what to ask for, what to expect. And they can learn that from each other. And I think that we're seeing that more and more, both informally and formally, these networks are being established in a variety of different professions, as well as places like Barnard. We have a tremendous amount of contact between our students and our alumni, and we encourage our students to ask those questions and our alumni to ask those questions of each other.
But
for women to help.
I think one thing, though, the point that she was making is that, salaries aren't transparent. And, let's say male salaries in a firm are substantially higher than all the female salaries in a firm. A woman's network is not going to be able to necessarily get you the information about what are the male salaries. And so, I think there is something to this notion, that that Supreme Court case was a real it was basically bad for women. I mean, it was a knockdown because
I couldn't agree more. It was terrible.
You know, now you have to rely upon, you know, sort of rumor and gossip to find out what the guy in the corner office is making.
Well, I do think that men and women do talk to each other. So
well, probably not about money.
That women can find out from their friends and partners and spouses, and that women can certainly find out. I think that you're right that the transparency of salaries does not exist, and it can be a little bit tricky. But there are also professional associations that have both men and women in them, where this kind of information can sometimes be available. It can be researched.
All right, let me get Jacqueline in here from Sunnyside. Jacqueline, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was, very interested in this whole segment because I am a 23-year-old recent graduate looking for work in the city. And I've been here for about 2 months now, and I still have not found a job. I still have not found a job that, you know, would support my, that I can support myself in, that would have benefits and that pays more than minimum wage. And even though there are some extremely successful women out there who should be applauded, they have to work very, very, very hard. And it's always an upward battle, it seems like. Also, just sort of commenting on other countries is that, you know, in college, it's one thing I studied was welfare state and the welfare state of the United States compared to the systems in other countries and how they are much more friendly to women having careers and having families, how there's maternal leave, paternal leave, state daycare. There's so many incentives, and I think that if the United States really wanted to make this a real concern and a real issue, that we would be instituting more of these types of programs.
All right, Jacqueline, thanks for your call. You know, we're sitting here talking about the reverse wage gap here in these big cities, but we should note, as we mentioned rather quickly earlier in the hour, that outside of major cities, the traditional remains, correct?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's almost like, I mean, if you look at some of these cities, you know, Minneapolis is another one. It's kind of like the blue state cities, women are ahead. You know, Los Angeles, Minnesota, and New York, Boston. And so there may be something to that. And I think that women, you know, but I also think it's another thing. I think there's a notion, like if a woman wants to come to New York, those probably aren't like the woman who just called who's looking for a job in New York, and I hope she's soon successful. Women who come to New York to kind of seek their fortune are probably not like the average woman, say, from Illinois. I mean, let's say you were in Peoria, Illinois. The Peoria, Illinois woman who comes to New York to find her fame and fortune is probably not actually similar, even if she's a college grad, of the Peoria, Illinois woman who stays in Peoria and marries her high school sweetheart or something.
Lois?
I absolutely agree with that, because there was a recent article that showed salary discrepancies by state.
Right.
And, for example, I was very surprised to see, I think it was Virginia or West Virginia, had the least disparity. And then, you know, you go into the South, places like, you know, Louisiana had the greatest disparity. But when you talk about these, you know, blue states, red states, I mean, that's what we all have to remember. That, you know, I live in Los Angeles, you're in New York, it's a bit skewed. Because going back to what Jennifer said about that particular Supreme Court decision, I appreciate you saying, Andrew, that it was really, you know, not a good thing for women. But if you read the findings, Chief Justice Roberts actually went so far as to say he found it a quaint notion that any group would need protection. And to me, that was the worst of everything that came out of that finding.
All right, let me try and get one last call in here. Linda is in Brooklyn. Linda, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm 25 years old. I'm a 25-year-old black woman who chose to leave the New York workplace and go back to school, actually, because I found it too frustrating. I was doing journalism, and I was at the Times magazine and at Vogue, and someone mentioned people coming in from other states and seeking their fortune or their careers in New York, and my cohorts at Vogue were definitely of that type, but they were able to work for free or next to nothing because the salaries that journalism pays aren't paying for their rent. They would get funding from family or whatnot, and I was not of that ilk, right. So I got too frustrated and had to leave.
Janie, are you finding that kind of frustration?
Absolutely. There are certain fields where there's no question that that's the case. And I think going back to school and looking for other opportunities is a good strategy for having a successful career in journalism. It's a tough one.
All right.
Yeah,
Demonger?
In certain parts of journalism also, I just want to point out, because
Lois, real quick.
Andrew alluded to this, that, you know, where you find more women going into a field, the salaries actually usually go down. So that if you look around publishing in New York, for example, it's predominantly women. It's predominantly women in these fields. And these fields are historically lower paid. They become what are called female ghettos.
All right, I'm going to have to leave it at that. Demographer Andrew Beveridge, Jane Selwyn, Dean of Career Development at Barnard College, and Lois Frankel, author and founder of Corporate Coaching International. Thanks, all three of you,
for being with us
this morning.
Thank you.
David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. When we return, Rebellious Kids.